Forest.
Forest.
Ujjagamhu.
Ujjagamhu.
Wind.
Wind.
Raharshena.
Raharshena.
With great delight.
With great delight.
Pranam.
Pranam.
Life.
Life.
Tanvaha.
Tanvaha.
Of the body.
Of the body.
Eva.
Eva.
Life.
Life.
Agatam.
Agatam.
Returned.
Returned.
Abhisangamya,
approaching.
Vidhiva, in due form. Parishvanga, embracing. Abhivadanai,
my
obeisances. With great delight, they all approached him as if life had returned to their bodies. They exchanged obeisances and welcomed each other with embraces. Responsibly, with great delight, they all approached him, as if life had returned to their bodies. They exchanged obeisances and welcomed each other with embraces, purport by Srila Prabhupada. In the absence of consciousness, the limbs of the body remain inactive. But when consciousness returns, the limbs and senses become active, and existence itself becomes delightful. Vidura was so dear to the members of the Kaurava family that his long absence from the palace was comparable to inactivity. All of them were feeling acute separation from Vidura, and therefore his return to the palace was joyful for all. Text again. With great delight, they all approached him, as if life had returned to their bodies. They exchanged obeisances and welcomed each other with embraces. This indicates that Vidura was not an ordinary person. The backstory of Vidura, which I think is narrated later, purport in this chapter, was that he was sentenced by Yamaraj. As a child, he did something childish, and he pierced a small insect. And somehow, he was brought before Yamaraj to pass judgment on him. Yamaraj is the Lord of Death. And he was sentenced to be skewered in a very harsh way. To be punished, to die, to be executed in this way. They had very harsh systems of punishment sometimes in those days. They still have some now. They're a little more cosmetic because they use like gas chambers and electric chairs, but they're still killing people. So Manduka Muni was accused of this very heinous act in his childhood, but being very powerful saint, he thought that this was too extreme. Therefore, he cursed Yamaraj. He cursed Yamaraj that he would have to take birth in the material world as a sutra. So, when we talk of Yamaraj, we have to know that the backstory is actually, when we speak of Vidura, we have to know that the backstory is actually that he is Yamaraj himself. He's not an ordinary person. Yamaraj is so intelligent that he is able to ascertain the sinful activities of human beings all over the universe, not an ordinary person. Even though he took birth as Vidura, as a sutra, he was very, very much missed. People could understand that he was a highly realized person. That's one of the methods of ascertaining seniority is austerity. Of course, birth and age and education and time of initiation, all those things are part of this idea of seniority and what an ashrama person is. But one of them is tapa or austerity. And Vidura was known for his particular austerity. He became famous because of his austerity. I mean, whether they knew or not that he was Yamaraj, he became famous for his... He wasn't an ordinary person. He had special ability. He was very, very highly realized. He was brother of Dhritarashtra, but born of a Sudrani, so he was considered a Sudra. Nonetheless, even though he was, according to Vedic knowledge, born in a lower level of family existence, he was very much missed in the palace. So when he returned after being away, he embraced many of the members of the palace, and they welcomed him back as if he were a long-lost son or relative, something like that. Actually, it's stated in the Bhagavatam, in the 11th canto of Bhishvadi Thadadini Shu, that there's a definition of a Majjhima Adhikari. And a Majjhima Adhikari is advised to make friends with devotees, to worship the Supreme Lord, make friends with the devotees, preach to the innocent people, and avoid the envious people. Of course, we take great risks in approaching the so-called envious people. Actually, when you calculate the number of years, 5,000, that have passed, it's a very small percentage of the entire Kali age, which is 432,000 years. So it works out to be about less than 2%. So even though we're very constantly approaching the so-called sinful denizens of Kali Yuga, maybe since it's just the beginning of the age, and since it deteriorates over time and becomes more and more simple, there are still many people who are theists or believers in God. Therefore, even though preaching can be a thankless task, and we have to take risks in approaching everybody, the calculation is that one out of four people will at least be theists, and they'll have some. There will be some element of God consciousness in those people. So that's the calculation. That if you know that things gradually deteriorate, and at the end of the age, almost everyone is atheistic and smaller in stature. And the 12th canto enumerates all the things that are wrong with people at the end of the age. But it's just the beginning. It's also mentioned in the Upadeshamrita, I think in the 4th chapter, Dadati Pradiganati Guhyamankati Prichati, that it's necessary to establish, to reveal our minds to devotees. Guhyamankati Prichati. Guhyam means secret revelations of the heart and mind. So those things are necessary. It's also said, I think, in the Adi Purana, Yome Bhakta, that one's who characterizes oneself as a devotee of Krishna is not actually his devotee, but one who says that he's a devotee of the devotee is actually the devotee of Krishna. So in a sense, a devotee of Krishna is as good as Krishna himself. Not as good always, but sometimes he is. And we sing in the morning, Yasya Prasadam, Bhagavat Prasadam, but by pleasing the spiritual master, one's life becomes successful, and Nikunja Yuna Vasikali Siddhaya, the spiritual master is to be considered as almost like the gopis. So in the sense that the spiritual master is an ordinary person, because we have a personal relationship with that person, we have a relationship with Krishna. And therefore, this is Vishwanath Chakravarti has said that the devotee, the Vaishnava, is as good as Krishna, not the same as Krishna, but given the same respect. And I think the example was given that someone who represents the king, like they used to have the viceroy in India, vice meaning vice king or viceroy, was given the same respect as if the king had come. This is what in that part of the world, in India. When the viceroy was present, the viceroy was given the same adulation and respect that they would ordinarily give to the king. This is, I mean, pre-1947, when India was being ruled by the British. The viceroy was given a lot of respect because they were the rulers of their colony, of the British colony of India. So it's been said that the Vaishnava, and then also somewhere in the Nectar Devotion it's stated that even if someone is involved in deity worship is generally the province of a Kanishtha Adhikari, someone who isn't so developed. Not that it is to be minimized, but it's said in the somewhere in the Nectar Devotion that if one is engaged in deity worship, but a devotee spontaneously turns up, that one should stop deity worship for the time being and attend to the devotee who is unannounced but present as a devotee. So this is part of making friendship with the devotees, fast friends. And that obviously was done in the case of Udira. They had made friendships with him. There's also a somewhat obscure thing, I think it was saying, it's one of the Prabhupada lectures. He talks about svajati, people of a similar caste. And then and what he goes on to say is that fast friendships should be made with people that are like-minded, especially people who we consider are more advanced than we are. They're to be considered very great people, and fast friendships are to be made with them. It's not that we're, as devotees, not friendly to everyone, but our intimacies, our intimate relationships, are reserved for devotees. So when it says that one should avoid the envious, it means when we are able to determine that someone is actually unchangeably atheistic or impersonalistic or something like that. Maybe they can't. Maybe it's useless to speak on end to such a person. I think there's a biblical saying to the effect that one should not cast one's pearls before swine. So similarly, one should not reveal the intimacies of Radha Krishna relationships to everyone. Prabhupada has often told us that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Lord Krishna, especially Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, would not reveal the inner feelings or relationships between Radha and Krishna to everyone. And especially if they were impersonalists, he just, like with Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya and Prakasananda Saraswati, he just discussed philosophy and Vedanta truths that were in the Vedanta. But he reserved talking about the intimate pastimes between Radha and Madhava to his intimate associates like Ramananda Roy and Shikha Mahiti and others. Reading the Chaitanya Chaitamrita, it becomes obvious that in those days there were many great and pure devotees, and Lord Chaitanya did not treat them as ordinary people. He had very, very intimate and loving relationships with many devotees. Because in those days, there were many devotees who were very advanced. Unfortunately, there's not so many now, but however many there are, it's worthwhile to develop fast friendships with them. Guhyam Akyati Prichiti, to develop fast friendships with them. And it's also said, and we pray regularly when we offer obeisances to one another, Vancha Kalpati Vichha, that devotees are like desire trees, that we can learn many things from devotees. And one of the things we can learn from them is just ordinary things. One of the qualifications, as I was mentioning, about devotees is their dhaka or daksha. They're expert. When we had the big screen on the stage for the 50th anniversary here, people were aware that devotees are not just unusual, people who make good food and they're nice people, but there's a certain level of, we might call it culture or sophistication or education or intelligence, of doing ordinary things. In this particular place, many things are being done. Houses are being built. Different halls are being erected. And good sound systems are in the process of developing, are already developed. These things require a certain level of material intelligence. They're in the realm of daksha or expertise. And that's one of the things a devotee is expert at. Just as we were reading in Bhagavad Gita, how Arjuna was singled out as being the person who would get the instruction directly from Krishna. He was a fighter and an expert bowman. Nonetheless, because he used it in Krishna's service, he was chosen to be the disciple who would renew the disciplic succession and be because he was a devotee of Krishna, would do a very ordinarily unsavory act. For instance, he had to engage in warfare. He had become angry. And this is, as I said before, is one of the rasas. Anger is one of the rasas of Krishna. It's interesting that Prabhupada used this illustration on the cover of his Bhagavad Gita book. Krishna and Arjuna riding into battle, not Krishna dancing with the gopis. So it's not that love is not a good thing, and Krishna's relationship with the gopis is not a good thing. But Prabhupada wanted everyone to know that there's another way that one can relate with Krishna, that one can be in battle with Krishna, can be doing something that's not particularly interesting or usual. And devotees are said to be lovers of everyone, insects, animals, plants, trees. There are many advocacy groups in favor of being kind to animals, being kind to trees. The hypocrisy of many of such advocacy movements and the people in them are that they don't realize that you can't be kind to animals and at the same time be an eater of flesh. But it exists. People who are passionately involved in the rights of animals are eating meat. It's just incredible how blind people are and how deep Vedic philosophy goes. It's not just being nice to people and animals and plants and trees and bushes and insects. I think Jains are some people who wear surgical masks so that they don't breathe in microbes because they believe in being kind to all. I think it's a form of, it's a type of, it's a strain of Hinduism anyway, I'm not sure exactly. But I've seen these people in different parts of the world wearing masks over their face and their mouth and nose. At the same time, as they walk, they step on insignificant creatures like ants and spiders. I don't mean to be cruel, but it's sort of hypocritical that they're nice to microbes and not nice to ants and spiders. There's a philosophy behind this known as Yukta Vairagya, Nashatasi Vishayam, which recently, this week, there was a conference held near Gita Nagari, in an Amish community. Someone who they'd made friends with, there was a house nearby, and it was held in that person's house. And the thing about that community, I mean, there's a lot to learn from them. David Prostis said that they make $2 billion. I mean, maybe it's an exaggeration, but that's what he said. I saw the tape, that they make $2 billion every year just on cottage industries and tourism and so on. And they sell farm implements. They sell a lot of things, but it's a kind of cottage industry. It's considered to be a sort of in the realm of self-sufficiency. But because there's no specific philosophy of Yukta Vairagya, it's a little vague as to how much technology is allowable and how much it is not allowable. For example, from what I know, telephones are not allowed in Amish communities. So if one wants to make a phone call, one has to go out to where there's a public telephone booth. It's not that they don't have the right idea about misusing technology, it's just that there's no all-embracing philosophy about this, known as Yukta Vairagya. According to the Yukta Vairagya philosophy, one can engage in anything, even fixing automobiles, as a service to Krishna. That goes on here. People fix automobiles and trucks, motor vehicles of all types, and they use farm implements that require motors. It's very difficult. In England, there's such a thing. There was such a thing anyway, 30 years ago, called intermediate. They called it intermediate technology. And their philosophy was that you could use technology in moving towards self-sufficiency, even if you're using pipes and nails and things that are used and petroleum, things that are treated and manufactured in factories. But it could be used for Krishna. So that's kind of what's going on everywhere. I mean, devotees are trying to be self-sufficient. I think there was a GBC resolution this year saying that by 2022, all farms should have a plan in place to drink only milk from protected cows. Of course, that sounds like a very big goal. It's not exactly a law, it's more of a recommendation. But there are people who won't drink even milk from protected cows because it doesn't fall into a certain category of milk. And there's a belief that certain cows, not of the Zebu or Gir variety, aren't really cows. I mean, that maybe is an extreme position, but some people in certain parts of the world have erected billboards that say that the Western cows, Holsteins, Frisians, Herefords, and so on, Guernseys and Jerseys, they're not real cows. The only real cow is a cow that has a big hump in the back and short white hair, which is kind of a form of what we have now. We have genderism and racism, but this is a form of speciesism, I guess you call it, speciesism, that you can't drink milk from certain cows, even though they're protected through their whole life. Because there's a theory that there's a particular brand of milk that is only produced by these white cows with short hair, Zebus or Yeers. There's a certain philosophy. It's been a little bit discounted. It's a little controversial, but there's even organizations that say that certain types of milk have to be drunk if you want to feel good or be healthy, and other types are not good. This is, in a way, it's contrary to Vedic philosophy and Varnashram life. As I understand it, Krishna was originally a cowherd boy who would drink milk directly out of the udders of cows. So this whole idea, this materialistic, industrialized system of milk production and distribution is a little bit strange. But there are activists. There are truly activists, and their whole life is dedicated to good health and so on and so forth, and drinking only good milk. But what really is good milk? So that's a big question that comes up. So I'll read the verse again, and if there are any comments or questions. With great delight, they all approached him. This is First Canto, Chapter 13, Text 6. With all great delight, they approached him, that's Vidura, as if life had returned to their bodies. They exchanged obeisances and welcomed each other with embraces. So any comments or questions? Is the verse making sense? Of course, Prabhupada did advocate that we should read Srimad Bhagavatam or hear it each day of the week. It's not an ordinary publication. So even though some verses seem to be a little remote and obscure, they're important. I remember there, I heard a tape, and I think I was present at the time in 1973, I think it was in July or August. Prabhupada was lecturing on the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita, and in the audience, first chapter of Bhagavad Gita is a very difficult chapter to lecture from, because most people think it's just a list of names, different warriors. But that was what Prabhupada was lecturing on. And he lectured on the point that the Kauravas were assessing the strength of the Pandavas. That's part of what's happening in the first chapter of Bhagavad Gita. The Kauravas were assessing their strength, how many armies had joined them, people from all different parts of the country had come to join them. And Prabhupada said that this is true, that you have to assess the strength of the enemy, especially in warfare it's true. But it's even true, and Prabhupada alluded to this, in the corporate world, people are spying, industrial spying, you might say, on their competitors. They have to know their strengths. They have to know how long they've existed, how many people work for them, what their philosophy is, what their strategy is. So industrial espionage is a very common affair. It's very common for a company, whatever it's producing, whether it's housewares or computerized technology, to know what the competition is doing. And therefore they're successful. And Prabhupada was saying in this lecture that people tend to lull themselves into a sense of security. They tend to think that we're making a lot of money, we're doing great, we're the number one company in the world. But He said that then all of a sudden someone comes along and takes everything away. He was alluding to the fact that we can be outdone by our enemies or our competitors, whatever they are. So it was kind of an interesting way to talk about the philosophy of the Bhagavad Gita in the first chapter. He brought some very interesting philosophy. So it's a good lesson to learn that this is not an ordinary book. Like Srimad Bhagavatam, of course, it's not an ordinary book. There's a lot to learn from each and every verse, even though it might seem unimportant or unobscure. Whenever I go to a Srimad Bhagavatam class, I always bring a pencil and paper. Of course, nowadays you can just bring your phone and do the same, a similar thing. But for us oldies, it's faster to have a pencil and a paper. So I always bring a pencil and a paper, because no matter who's speaking, no matter how obscure or remote the verse might be, I think there's something to learn from everyone. Maybe it's just one word or one sentence, but that person has a realization. It may seem unimportant, it may not be very advanced, but it's a realization. And everyone who hears Bhagavatam or Bhagavad Gita has a realization to share with others. Yes.
Just at the beginning of your lecture, you mentioned about the Kali Yuga, 400,000, where 5,000 years into it, very little way into it. And at this point, Srila Prabhupada, can you elucidate on this? I've only heard you whispering about this virtually to somebody, that there would be 10,000 years where this movement progress, the Hare Krishna movement, and that there's a great opportunity, because making the point, going out and preaching, it's an opportunity to be so many personalities to assist going back home to Godhead. This was in a discourse. What other references are there for this 10,000 year period to your knowledge?
I can't name specific scriptures, but there are several. There's at least three or four that say that within the Kali Yuga there would be a 10,000 year period that would be started by the people of Western countries, and that it would be kind of like summer in the middle of winter, a very pious period and a very distressing and difficult and materialistic age. People would become spiritual. And some people say that the Golden Age, as it's sometimes called, has already begun. And there are other people that say that it hasn't begun yet. Yeah, and there are some that said it's just starting. And whenever Prabhupada was asked about this, he was a little bit vague as to, you know, when it would happen, if it was already happening, if it was starting or whatever. No one has been able to ascertain exactly when this period takes place. But other than the fact that it's in this age of Kali and that it starts in with Westerners. So there's a lot to be said for thinking it's already started. I think once Prabhupada was in a conversation, and one of the devotees in the room said, an American, said that the crime rate in this country has gone down over the last year. And is that because of the Hare Krishna movement? And Prabhupada, after thinking for a few seconds, said something like, yes, we'll take credit for that. But it wasn't an indication that the Golden Age had started. I mean, people sometimes took it that way, but I think that was kind of a minority view. Any other comments or questions? Okay, Hare Krishna, thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai.